This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Hi, I'm Jamie Busson. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss what it's like to live with IBD with Rachel Meehan. We'll learn how to overcome mirror anxiety with naturopath Dr. Natalia Borakowski. We'll discover the benefits of chakra psychology with psychologist and author Dr. Julie Merriman. And lastly, we'll find out about preventative nutrition with researcher Dr. John Lewis. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. New research from the University of East Anglia, published in the Journal of Molecular Ecology, suggests that people you live with may influence your gut health more than you think. Scientists found that close social contact can lead to the sharing of gut bacteria, which are important for digestion and immunity. The study focused on a small bird called the Seychelles warbler living on Cousin Island in the Seychelles. Researchers collected and analyzed hundreds of samples over several years to understand how gut microbes spread between birds. They discovered that birds who spent more time together, such as breeding pairs and helpers, had more similar gut bacteria. This was especially true for anaerobic bacteria, which can only survive in low oxygen environments and are passed through close contact rather than surrounding environment. Researchers believe similar patterns likely occur in humans. Everyday interactions like hugging, sharing food, and spending time together may help transfer beneficial bacteria. These findings suggest that close relationships could play a role in shaping overall health. I'll be joined by Rachel Meehan in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. Canada has one of the highest rates of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, the two main forms of inflammatory bowel disease, otherwise known as IBD, in the world. By 2030, it's expected that 1 in 100 people in Canada will be impacted by IBD. The AbbVie IBD Scholarship helps students with IBD achieve their academic goals while they make a lasting and meaningful difference in their communities. Crohn's and Colitis Canada awards 15 aspiring students living with IBD a one-time scholarship to support their education at a Canadian post-secondary institution. Today, we're going to be speaking with Rachel Meehan, AbbVie IBD scholar and Crohn's advocate. Welcome to the show, Rachel. How are you?
I'm fine, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey with Crohn's, your symptoms, and how you came to be diagnosed?
Sure. I was diagnosed about 20 years ago, actually in 2006 was when my diagnosis came. But I want to say that I probably started symptoms probably around 2001. So for about 5 years, I suffered with symptoms without actually having an official diagnosis, which, you know, was called maybe that I had irritable bowel syndrome, tried changing a lot of my diet, all kinds of different things. But really, it ended up taking a lot out of me. I found that, you know, I was having bowel movements kind of 7-10 times a day. I was waking up in the middle of the night to have a bowel movement. I tried changing my diet and my whole family rallied behind me. And it was like, okay, you're going to start eating, you know, all the fresh fruits and veggies and all the whole wheat crackers and all the other things that you can do. And we really, you know, found that while I was doing my post-secondary education, having those snacks handy would be helpful. And it ended up it made me even more ill, and which I later found out when I did have Crohn's disease that it was because, you know, all those things that are really high in fiber are actually not great for Crohn's disease patients.
Right.
So what ended up happening was that when I had my colonoscopy, finally, I had to advocate for myself and say, like, nothing is working, nothing will work, nothing you're recommending is working, what can we do? And they sent me for a colonoscopy, and right away, the GI doctor who performed it said, it's very clear, you have Crohn's disease.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, just do you have a family history of IBD?
Not If I do, nobody that's been diagnosed.
And unfortunately, I had a family member who had ulcerative colitis. And so it's a good thing that we knew that because, you know, I have regular colonoscopies. And, right. You know, I have issues too. I don't have Crohn's and I don't have colitis. But, you know, there's things like polyps and things that can develop and diverticulitis, et cetera, which I did suffer from and had an emergency. So I'm with you. I know it's a little bit scary.
For sure.
So what did you know about Crohn's disease before you were actually diagnosed?
Absolutely zero. So I remember when the doctor said to me, "You have Crohn's disease." I looked at him and I said, "What's that?" And, you know, automatically it was fear, right? Like the word disease doesn't really give you, you know, a lot of hope. And so I was like, "Oh my gosh, what's Crohn's disease?" And the first thing the doctor said was, "It's manageable. Like, don't worry, it's not terminal. We're going to figure this out for you," right? Mm-hmm. So I knew nothing and then very quickly became quite well-versed in it because, you know, now when you've been diagnosed with something, you want all the answers and you want them right away.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways you're fortunate because you got the disease after, you know, they have these new treatments, right? You know, it used to be there were steroidal treatments and other things that weren't necessarily as effective as some of the treatments they have today.
Absolutely.
So how did Crohn's impact your early education?
Well, like I was kind of mentioning earlier, I was really suffering with it during my undergrad. And so I found myself exhausted a lot. I found, you know, multiple trips to the bathroom during class. I found it difficult to study. My concentration wasn't always there or my energy levels, but also knew that, you know, I needed to pursue my education. So I kind of forced myself through it, really wishing now in retrospect that I knew if I had known that I had Crohn's disease, I might have been able better able to manage the symptoms. So it was tough during undergrad for sure. Luckily, when I went and pursued my master's degree, I was being treated properly and knew all the different tips and tricks to make myself a little bit more successful in that. And so I did notice a huge difference in terms of my energy levels, even my academic performance between the two degrees and just being treated and untreated.
So what were you studying?
I did my undergraduate degree in education at Concordia University in Montreal, and then I ended up doing my master's degree in leadership at the University of Guelph.
And how did you come to hear about the AbbVie IBD scholarship?
So even though I did my studies in Guelph, I live in Sudbury, Ontario now. I moved here about 10 years ago. And when I moved to Sudbury, I had been offered a job and I came to Sudbury and I didn't know anybody. I came here by myself, no friends, no family, no partner. And I thought, okay, how am I going to get integrated into this community? And right away, I thought about Crohn's and colitis. And so what I did was that I joined a local chapter. Being involved in that chapter, I started to meet other people who were dealing with Crohn's and colitis. So I almost found a support group. And then also, it was almost like a silver lining to the disease where I was able to make friendships, become involved in community, started to give back in different ways through the Gutsy Walk or different events or even mentorship or things like that. And I would say that's really how I got involved, with Crohn's and colitis.
And what about the scholarship? How did you find out about that?
I found out about the scholarship through exactly that programming. So once you're a little bit more connected, and I hadn't heard about it previously, but because I was speaking to Crohn's and colitis more often than not, they were sending a lot of information about all the resources that are available to patients who live with Crohn's disease or colitis. Once I decided to pursue my master's, I thought, hey, well, you know what? I'll throw my hat in the ring and see if I'm fortunate enough to be considered an AbbVie scholar. And sure enough, I was selected as one of the lucky recipients.
So, you know, we hear about people getting scholarships in a sort of abstract. Can you sort of speak to like what that scholarship meant to you and what it helped you achieve?
Absolutely. I mean, I think for anybody, whether you suffer with chronic illness or not, when you receive a scholarship, there is a financial burden that is lifted from your shoulders. And I'm not going to say that it covered my entire tuition because tuition is not cheap, but every little bit helps. And so, when you think that most people have financial burdens and financial stressors and they're trying to figure out how they're going to pay back their student loans, because that's more often than not how people can afford education, just knowing that that was something less that I had to worry about, I would say improved my overall health and just my stress levels in general.
Let's sort of skip ahead to today and maybe you can explain what it's like living with Crohn's, like your day to day and how the medications work and what you have to avoid and what you need to do and what you can do that you couldn't do before.
So I had major surgery in 2011, where I had 25 centimeters of small intestine removed, as well as my appendix due to a complication related to Crohn's disease. And after that, I was probably in remission for about 3 years. And then I had to start medication over again. And then a couple of years after that, I went to biologics, and I've been on biologic drugs now, probably for about 6 or 7 years, if I had to guess. And it has been life-changing for me. We're still playing around with the dosages. It changes as my disease progresses. It's been under control, and I have a lot more energy than I did, and there's a lot more consistency. But there are still things that, you know, I still deal with as a Crohn's patient. I still deal with fatigue regularly. I'm still constantly looking at nutrition and what are the things that aggravate me and things that don't. And that's not static either. That changes. I feel like, you know, I remember points during my disease where there were certain fruits and vegetables I couldn't eat. Now I can tolerate them. And there's other things that'll send me into a flare. So I wish there was something, you know, predetermined where it was like, if you have Crohn's, avoid these foods. But that's not always the case. Everybody's different. So there's still a lot of trial and error. I go for colonoscopies every other year. And on the off years, I'm doing ultrasounds. I go to the clinic for my infusions probably every 5 weeks, potentially looking at 4 now. So there is still a commitment to that. But I feel more in control than I ever have. So just having that plan and having a solid GI doctor that helps support me with that as well, and a, you know, a solid partner and friends and family and support network, I think that it's made the disease a lot more bearable.
The biologics are not cheap. Is this something that's covered?
I am fortunate enough that I work for an employer that does provide insurance, but I know that if you are successful on a biologic and you do not have insurance, there is some funding available through AbbVie that can make that possible for you.
So you're an advocate for the Crohn's community in Guelph and Sudbury. What kind of resources are available?
Yeah, if you're interested in getting involved with Crohn's and colitis, there's lots of opportunities. You know, like I mentioned, I had joined a local chapter and participate in local events. And that's true, not just in Guelph and Sudbury. It's available across the country. Every year they do a signature Gutsy Walk, which is their main fundraiser for the year. It's a great day as long as the weather cooperates, you know, and I think, you know, you'll get to meet a lot of people, and it's like suddenly it's a day where it's like, oh, we can talk about poop and we can do all these different things, right? And everybody's rallying and wearing, you know, poop emojis and all kinds of other things, and it suddenly kind of normalizes the disease, right? There's Gutsy learning seminars, like a webinar series, online communities for mentorship. There's no shortage of things that the Crohn's and Colitis, or that Crohn's and Colitis Canada are doing. And I think if you're interested, just go and check out their website and find what's the right fit for you.
So my experience, you know, I've been in health and wellness for decades now, and, you know, the resources that are available in the GTA are sometimes vastly different than in other parts of the province. Is that an issue for you? Like where you are you getting full service?
It's tough to say. We definitely find that because I also used to live in the GTA, I decided to keep my GI doctor when I moved to Sudbury in Toronto. I felt I had such a strong rapport with her that it made sense. And she knew, like, she was my doctor when I had my surgery. And to me, it just makes sense. The drive from Sudbury to Toronto was about 4 hours. It's something that's manageable for me. But speaking to others in the community who do suffer with Crohn's and colitis, there is a shortage, especially in Northern Ontario. We definitely have a shortage of physicians, period. And so there are a few GI doctors in the city, but it, you know, it can take a long time to be seen. And sometimes, you know, you don't have a lot of time, right? Depending on the symptoms that you're dealing with. I think it just speaks to our healthcare system in general. There's an opportunity for more physicians and more support. And again, I'm not sure that's related or that's necessarily just tied to Crohn's and colitis, but kind of across the field, but we definitely feel it. We feel it up here for sure.
You know, my experience, and obviously, you know, it's a fraction of what you've had to deal with, but when I had my issues, I found there was a huge psychological element to it when you're dealing with things that like aren't, people don't want to talk about, like this. And, you know, it impacts your health in so many different ways. So for example, you know, it changed the way I worked out. I ended up tearing the muscles in my stomach with all the surgeries that I had. And, you know, my whole lifestyle changed and I had to eat differently, which I think you alluded to. How do you keep up on the psychological side?
Like I said, I'm very lucky that I have a really good support network, but some days it still can feel a little alienating. It's that experience where it's like people haven't walked in your shoes, so people can try to relate, but they don't really understand exactly what that means for you. So having the community of Crohn's and colitis people actually does help with that. Like I have a pretty good friend that I can go to when I'm feeling symptoms or I'm worried about something that I'm not sure that others would quite understand, even despite their best efforts. So I think finding that person who has a similar lived experience is really important. I also have a bunch of psychological supports as well. My therapist is very aware of the phases of my disease and what that looks like, and the anxieties that can come with that. So I make sure that I get the support that I need in a variety of ways. So I just try to ensure that I'm just listening to my body at the best of times, right? So if I'm tired, I'm not pushing myself to do that workout, right? It's like, okay, Rachel, you gotta take a rest right now, right? Like there's no point in pushing yourself so that you're gonna get sick.
I hear you. Last question. What advice do you have for someone who's living with Crohn's or maybe just got diagnosed?
Just take care of yourself. There's no question that stress really is a huge inflammation marker. It really can send your system into a state you don't want to be in. And I mean, that's true for anybody who doesn't have Crohn's and colitis, but it really is somebody who lives with chronic illness. If there's any way that you can kind of minimize those stressors in your life, I would say that's the way to do it. Listen to your body. Nobody knows what you're feeling more so than you. And you have to be that voice. You have to be that advocate. So when I'm feeling symptoms, my GI doctor had said to me years ago, if you're having a symptom and you don't think it's related to Crohn's, let me be the one to decide that, right? Like,
Yeah.
don't make that decision for yourself. Bring it to me, and then I'll tell you if I think it's related or not, because there's so many things when you're talking about an autoimmune disease. Like I've had issues where I've had psoriasis, I've had rheumatoid arthritis in my ankles, all these different things that we do think are actually related to my Crohn's and my body responding in different ways. So be the advocate, use your voice, raise the questions, and get the answers, right? Don't just make assumptions that things are not related, because more often than not, they have been. And so be your best self and try to do what you have to make sure that your needs are taken care of.
Fantastic advice. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Rachel Meehan. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss mirror anxiety on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Natalia Borakowski is a licensed naturopathic physician specializing in women's health and cosmetic dermatology. With nearly two decades of experience in aesthetic medicine, she integrates evidence-informed skin biology, hormonal physiology, and lifestyle medicine into patient care. Her clinical focus includes age-related skin changes, stress physiology, and the intersection between endocrine transitions and visible aging. She's particularly interested in how midlife hormonal shifts affect collagen integrity, inflammation, and tissue quality, and she advocates for medically responsible, biologically grounded aesthetic decision-making. Her work emphasizes preserving natural anatomy, supporting long-term tissue health, and aligning aesthetic interventions with overall physiological well-being. Wow. Welcome to the show, Natalia. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jamie. So excited to be here.
So, you know, given your practice, I know that, you know, one of your focus topics is a notion called mirror anxiety, which I think is really interesting. Maybe we should start by sort of explaining what mirror anxiety is and how it might manifest.
Yes, yes. Well, let me just give you a little bit of a history. I developed this term because I felt like I had to give this phenomenon a name. And it started with a sort of a ritual I developed with every patient, or new or old, doesn't matter, coming to my clinic. And the first thing I do, I hand her a mirror. And I just watch how she behaves with her own reflection. So typically two things that I see. First, the woman looking at her reflection, she's just starting to break her face apart and then just pulling out every possible flaw, either it's visible or invisible, and basically saying how horrible it is and using very negative adjectives as she describes herself. And the second behavior, it's what I call the avoidance behavior. It's when a woman briefly looks at her reflection and then just puts the mirror down and looks at me and said, well, you know, it's terrible. Let's just fix it. So either way, it always feels like the woman does not have a good, healthy connection with her reflection. So either she sees it very critically or she completely avoids it, which is still very negative and very critical. So the question becomes, why is it important for a woman to have a healthy relationship with her reflection? And it's really nothing has to do with vanity. It essentially comes from us doctors who are taking care of skin, educating our patients that skin is the most visible and the largest organ in our body. It gives women clues of what's happening inside her body. So I really want to teach my patients and to any woman who listens to really truly reconnect with her reflection. And I'm not meaning by examining in a critical way, but just observing what's happening, because our face does change day to day. So it's not necessarily something that you hated today will be negative tomorrow. But developing this healthy relationship and rituals with the mirror is the first step to connection with your health.
You're describing something that I think is akin or similar or is a component of what you're talking about, sort of like body dysmorphia, right? Where we don't really see ourselves authentically. You know, I'm somebody who struggled with weight my entire life, and I know when I look in the mirror, I see things that people probably don't even care about, but they're important to me. Do you see that in your practice? Is that a part of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. But, you know, body dysmorphia does have, it's a very difficult psychological disease to treat.
Yep.
So I would say the mirror anxiety, it's more of a lighter form of it, if you will. And the difference is, Jamie, the mirror anxiety varies day by day. So it's more something that I see in female patients because, you know, our mood changes depending into our based on our hormones and stress level, the how much a woman slept, you know, what's her social emotional load for the day, and so on. When body dysmorphia, it tends to be sort of a persistent fixation on one specific feature. And not always it really affects the face, but it affects the entire complexion, the body composition. So mirror anxiety, it's typically something that affects the face only, and it varies. Like today, this woman might be upset with her skin tone. Tomorrow, she's focused on the size of her pores, and the day after, she doesn't like her dark circles. So that's the difference. Does that make sense?
It does. So what's driving the fact that so many women feel discomfort when they look at themselves in the mirror? Is it just them, or are there other factors at play here?
There's many factors at play. The first is our societal pressure. We are first generation of women that's aging in the front of million mirrors. So everybody now has iPhone or whatever smartphone. They can take a picture of you in the most unflattering angle. And then you see it posted on social media for a public view. And then you start criticizing yourself and seeing flaws that might not even belong to your face. It's just that really poor angle of camera or bad lighting emphasized certain shadows on the face. And now you see a feature that doesn't even exist, but your brain magnifies that flaw. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So I understand, you know, you advocate for mirror hygiene. Can you explain what that term means and what how that would manifest?
The mirror hygiene is not my term. I borrowed it from one of my colleagues. She's an esthetician, and she talked about the mirror connection for at least a decade, as far as I know. So for mirror hygiene, one of the first things she says, it's important to keep uncluttered space of where you engage with your reflection. So typically that's when we talk about skincare rituals, to make sure that you have a clean mirror. So again, the lens that looking through your face needs to be clean, because if there's a, again, bad lighting, if there's some smudges in the mirror, you start to see things in your face that don't belong. And that creates a disconnection, anxiety, and just discomfort with your own reflection. So creating clean space is a number one step. The second is to allow yourself to have an interrupted few minutes when you truly connect with your skin. You're not just examining, but you taking on clues of what your skin is telling you. Is it puffy today? Is it looking dull? And then you can take steps of perhaps addressing it either topically or internally. And I'm not going to get in specific details there, but essentially creating that moment of stillness, the moment when you can take in information without rushing in it, without criticizing it, and also be aware of what narratives coming up to your head as you're looking at your reflection. And catch yourself, if you are starting to look at yourself very negatively, take a deep breath and ask, why am I feeling this way? And then think, maybe, yes, I didn't get enough sleep. Maybe I'm upset about that phone call I got from my boss, or whatever else is driving this negative behavior today.
How does one's internal self-image shape and distort what we see externally?
Internal self-image is a very fascinating concept. When I was diving into this whole psychology of how we are affected by our internal self-image, what I discovered for most adults, both men and women, our internal image sort of crystallizes about at the age of 28 to 32. And this is what our brain perceived we should look like. And when you start to see yourself age, this deviation from your internal comfort image, specifically for women, because our society really embraces youth, like youth is equal beauty, that becomes a very difficult psychological relationship that you sort of have to develop. And this is what we see in aesthetic medicine. Even very young women in their 20s starting to chase that very perfect, never aging face, which is really unhealthy in both medical and a psychological level.
Why do you think the age is between 28 and 32 where we see our, I wouldn't frame it necessarily our peak self, but our ideal self? Like, why is it that age? Do you have a sense of that?
Again, this is not the number I came up with. It's sort of what psychiatrists and psychologists through the research developed. Perhaps it has something to do with the development of prefrontal cortex. We know it's typically peaks at the age of 25, and that's really when a person matures and becomes feeling more so as an adult. I know the adulting overall, it's a difficult conversation. Some people don't really fully become adult until they're in their 40s, but that's a different level because it's a maturity level we're talking about. As of human being, as your own persona, because that's where aesthetic medicine becomes so powerful, because we are changing the face, and the face, it's where identity lives. So if the brain crystallizes that face as it should look like about at the age of late 20s, early 30s, then whatever changes we are creating in aesthetic medicine can potentially alter that person's relationship with the identity or the identity altogether. That's why this whole conversation about the psychology and identity, in my opinion, is very important, at least creating the awareness for both practitioners and the patient. So when they're making changes of changing something on their face, it will be changing their identity.
It's interesting because, I'm not going to give you my age, but it's well north of 40. But I don't imagine myself, or I don't see my peak self in late 20s or early 30s. I see it kind of like late 30s, mid 40s. I'm wondering, do you see in the people that you're treating that their ideal, their paradigm, their fixed idea is it gets older as they get older? Or are you saying that the women that you're treating are still thinking of themselves as, that 28 to 32 year old person, maybe even if they're in their 50s or 60s?
Let me just explain. So essentially for men, it's much easier to accept their new image of whatever their 40s or 50s, because again, society does not punish men for looking older. If anything, we are even celebrate the men, you know, what they call it, the salt and pepper here, you know, having the little lines on the face and makes them more mature, more desirable. For women, it's a different story. So the whole narrative is, like I actually describe it in my book, is youth equals beauty. And for women, beauty is her value. So it's sort of a currency that she presents to the world. So if those two statements are true, then aging is bankruptcy. So if her identity of what she perceives herself to be is, as psychologists suggest, is in early 20s, and all of a sudden she sees this photo of herself, and then she's my age, which is, you know, close to 50, and all of a sudden she sees those shadows on her face, the lines that she wasn't really truly aware of, because what's so fascinating is our biology gradually changes, and often brain is not aware of those changes until something happens in your life. It's either someone taking a photo of you, or you seeing yourself in a very unflattering angle of a Zoom camera. Then you become aware of whatever that flaw is. And it just really feels like you have that perception identity split. You don't recognize yourself. So that's often when a woman, it turns into a panic of chasing herself for where she was, where her brain thinks that she should be. And then she runs into either plastic surgery office or aesthetic injector and trying to fix this. And what we're trying to educate is the biology changes gradually. And what the best things you can do is to address your skin health early and take care of your skin when you're still very young, because your skin will age. But the same thing as it is with physique, for example, right? You said you lost a lot of weight at some point. It's much easier to maintain healthy weight throughout the entire life than be in a position when you are already developing disease like diabetes, and now you're facing this challenge of losing 100 plus pounds. It's so much more difficult to get your body into that state. So that's really why this whole communication is important, because we are trying to communicate to younger patients instead of trying to fix themselves and trying to look like a Kardashian. That's what we see in the younger patients a lot of times. Instead, you look at your skin as a living organ and you honor it and support it. And more so, you support it from inside, not necessarily just putting the new fancy serums on.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain that.
That was great conversation. Thank you, Jamie.
That was Dr. Natalia Borakowski. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss chakra psychology on The Tonic. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lovers Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Julie Merriman is a PhD professor and counselor who aids high-achieving women over the age of 50 in reigniting their spark. As the founder of the Soul Joy brand, she serves as a premier authority on nervous system regulation to heal burnout and rekindle intimacy. As author of the forthcoming publication, Are We Gonna Have Sex or What?, which is out this month, Dr. Merriman is committed to helping women feel sexy, powerful, in and after midlife. And for more information, you should visit www.juliemerrimanphd.com. Welcome back, Julie. How are you?
I am great. Good to be back.
So today we're going to talk about something that is new to me, and it's hard after this many years in health and wellness to hear something new. It kind of sounds like a blend of a few ideas, and you can edify. We're going to talk about chakra psychology. Sound like a plan?
It sounds like a plan.
So a lot of women are told that, you know, their midlife symptoms are just their hormones, you know, perimenopause, etc. What made you start questioning that narrative?
Well, honestly, it's when I hit it and I was like, man, is this all life has to offer? I have busted my butt for all these years and I wake up and I feel numb and I'm in this functional freeze. My poor nervous system has been on overdrive for 30 years. And it really made me start questioning what society, what people had told me over the years, you know, just hang it up. You ready to retire? And I wasn't. And the women I work with weren't either. So it really made me go in and question what is going on. Because I had done my hormone replacement and, you know, I'd done the things you're supposed to do. I had my quote marks around supposed to. And I still didn't feel aligned. I didn't feel like myself again. And that's really what set me on researching and working with women in this age group. Because, you know, we're not done. There's a lot more left to be said after. I'm 63 right now, and I feel like I'm a kid in a candy store.
Yeah, I hear you. And you know, the average North American, I don't think, can just kind of like go out to pasture, you know, in their late 50s or 60s. You know, like the way the economy is, you know, whether we want to or not, I think a lot of us still want to be out there working, socializing, doing things. And, you know, that's the message that we're sent in some regards, but not in others. And I think that adds to the stress. I don't know if you see that. What are you seeing in your practice?
The ladies I work with, for them, they want to keep working just because they have some things they still want to get accomplished. They're not finished, if you will. And I work with high achieving women, doctors, nurses, counselors, professors, folks that have worked really hard to get the education they have. They've got a huge knowledge base that they've built over the years, and they're just not ready to hang it up. Now, they might look at, I'm sick of all this stress. I'm sick of living on this cocktail of cortisol and adrenaline and being in this functional freeze where I'm going, 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 but I'm living in this numb body. I've got to do life a little different. I've got to get this nervous system regulated. So they might be looking at taking all those skills they've acquired and packaging them a little different where they're not in such a high stress job, if you will. Instead of being a doctor with, you know, 1,000 patients they're taking care of, which I just made that number up, but it's a high number.
Right.
They can package those skills and be a consultant to a university. I mean, you know, there's a way that they can continue earning money and giving to society, but do it in a way where they have their nervous system regulated and they are feeling fully embodied. And that is, I mean, that's where chakra psychology came in. I saw all these women who were these floating heads of competence who were completely disconnected from their bodies. They would do these wonderful things and it was almost like a stranger was doing it. They just had no tie to their outcomes, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I'm a former commercial litigator. I made the decision to sort of get out of that stream a long time ago and go into health and wellness. So I certainly understand it. And I certainly see it among my peers, the women who, you know, I've worked with over the years and where they see themselves at their career, you know, in this age cohort. You touched upon chakra psychology. Can you give us sort of like a primer about what that is?
Yeah, it's, I'm also a yoga instructor. I use a lot of yoga movement in my therapy because I'm a very somatic therapist. I don't think we can just sit on our bottom and do our work. We're very good about thinking, but we have to move that energy through our body. I'm also trained in bioenergetic therapies. So that's kind of what got me curious about chakras, those two modalities. And I noticed that if I take a lady through, or a man, anyone, a person through a full body scan, and where we're scanning their chakras, you know, chakras are energy centers. If you think of a little spinning wheel, if you will, in various, we have seven in our body. Those are the seven I focus on. But if I take a person through a full body scan from the crown chakra to the third eye chakra, which is between your eyes, your throat chakra, heart chakra, which is your chest, the solar plexus, which is upper belly, sacral, lower belly, and then your root from your sitz bones down. If I take a person through that and have them just be curious about what they're, any kind of physical something they might be feeling instead of judging it, I was shocked with the outcome. Someone might tell me, now first, Jamie, first it takes a hot minute to get someone who has never tried to scan their body and be curious about physical sensations. That's very foreign. And it takes a hot minute to get used to that. I've had people get irritated with me, like, I don't feel anything, Julie. I'm doing this wrong. No, you're not. It's a new neural pathway. You're trying to train yourself to be embodied. But what I would find when we finally had folks who could body scan and talk to me about places they're feeling things, a lady might say, you know, my chest is really tight today. So that's your heart chakra. So that's about relationships. So the first thing I'm going to do is start asking her, tell me more about what's going on in your relationships today. And, you know, every time there's going to be, this person might say, well, you know, I got in a fight with my husband today and I just don't know about this marriage. And we've been married so long and desire's gone and we're just like roommates. And that gives me something to really start digging in and helping her explore. But Jamie, that's true wherever, maybe it's their throat is tight and they're really struggling with their authenticity. The ladies I work with, especially if we're looking at desire and feeling safe in our body, it's very important to get that root chakra balanced. That's our first chakra to form. That's where safety lives. And if a person doesn't feel safe in their bodies, and I don't mean like you're going to get hurt. I'm talking about thinking a saber-toothed tiger's chasing you because you're missing all these deadlines or you have deadlines and this is being demanded of me and that, this and the other, kicks your nervous system into survival mode. And we're not going to get out of survival mode until we get that root chakra where it feels safe. And you know, when we're in that survival mode, it also messes up your dopamine receptors. I mean, so many things get offline when we haven't balance that nervous system and those chakras. And something that's interesting, I think, with the polyvagal theory, that vagus nerve that is so important for us to get toned runs right down the center of your chakra system. So I just felt like that was a very normal place to go with the work I was doing to look more at the chakra psychology and help people understand that.
So if somebody's caught in this zone where you know they're in hypervigilance and you know they're being reactive and you know they're being impacted by their life, how might they recognize what's going on without having the language for it yet?
They're going to feel paralyzed. They're going to feel just like it's not safe to stop. They just have to stay in motion. Maybe they. Well, yeah. Okay. I'm thinking of a lady I work with. For her, she had an assignment and we start small because we don't want to destroy nervous systems, right? Mm-hmm. it's already taxed. But her assignment was to just find 30 minutes on a Saturday and do nothing. Just watch birds fly, look at the sunshine, stare at the leaves, whatever, just 30 minutes. She could not do it for 30 minutes. She struggled to do it for 5 minutes because she had been so conditioned to be doing, to be serving, to be scanning for other people's needs before she ever thought about her own.
Yeah. I mean, you're describing, so I used to teach spinning at a studio, which also had yoga. So I would take classes and I could not lie in Shavasana at the end. I couldn't do it. My mind would race and, it's the simplest thing in the world, right? You're lying in corpse pose and you're not supposed to move and you're supposed to focus on your breathing and just kind of drift. And I couldn't do it. You know, I'd be back to like the work that needed to get done or whatever. And I think that's what you're describing, isn't it?
That's exactly it. I'm wasting time. What am I doing this? I got to be doing something. So often I found with the ladies I'm working with, and mind you, I mean, I'm 63. The gals I work with are 40 and above. Mm-hmm. It was a different time of raising kids, if you will. But so often we learned our value was tied to our performance. And then we get into these overachieving careers and that's just reinforced, right?
Yeah.
So when you try to not do something, you feel like you're going to crawl out of your skin. You just, it does not feel natural. So we've really, I mean, that's where I start with a lot of gals, is just give them an assignment to find, you know, to try okay, and work up to 30 minutes.
Okay. So, listeners may recognize some of this in themselves, right? If this resonates, other than watching birds, what other types of assignments are our first assignments that you would give somebody who's struggling with this?
Absolutely. The goal is to thaw and flow. So a good vagus reset would be, you know, we want to move out of that freeze. So we've got to introduce gentle micro movements to signal safety to our brain. So the sight shift, and we, you know, that's the sit still without moving your head. You just let your eyes kind of wander far to the right and then far to the left. And while you're doing that, you're inhaling deeply and you give a hum as you exhale, getting that, because the vagus nerve is what we're really trying to tone. So that deep breath into your chest. And you know, here in the States, instead of when we inhale deep, we've been taught to suck our stomach in so much, we don't take the breath in like we need to. So, I mean, I want you to let that tummy flop, you know, take it a big deep breath.
Yeah.
And when you exhale, you do a voo, just where you're feeling your throat and your chest vibrate, because we're wanting to stimulate that nerve, and doing an identity anchor as you're doing that. I am allowed to be a person, not just, you know, the label that I wear. I'm allowed to just be a person. We've got to give ourselves permission. And I think it's very important to say that out loud. And I really encourage people to say their name first. Your brain, that amygdala, it's always scanning. And when it hears your name, it's like, oh, hell, she's talking to me. What? And just to remind yourself, I'm worthy. I'm allowed to be just a person. That's a great place to start.
It's a great place to start. And unfortunately, it's a great place to finish. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, Jamie, thank you so much.
That was Dr. Julie Merriman. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss preventative nutrition on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
John E. Lewis, PhD, is the founder and president of Dr. Lewis Nutrition and past full-time associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and now voluntary associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He's also a diplomate, faculty member, and advisor of the Medical Wellness Association. He's been the principal investigator of over 30 different studies in his research career, and during that time, he either directly raised or indirectly supported raising over $23 million in grants, gifts, and contracts for research studies and clinical trials. Welcome back to the show, John. How are you?
Thank you, Jamie, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm telling everybody today, fair to middling, which I think is true, but that's fine. You don't need to worry about me. I'll pull through.
Pulling for you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So new government in the United States, not brand new, but relatively new, dealing with all sorts of health and wellness issues, including new nutrition recommendations, advocating for the increased consumption of red meat. So this is relatively new news, but I thought it'd be interesting to bring you on the show so we could discuss these new recommendations and how they're grounded and what the key takeaways are. Sound like a plan?
That sounds great. Let's do it.
So what do you think about this notion that now we should be eating more red meat?
I think it's very unfortunate, Jamie. I think that when RFK was running for president, and I know you guys are in Canada, so forgive this American perspective, but he was running on a platform not only about lots of things of, you know, problems in our government, but one of the big ones was this, as he always referred to, the corporate capture of government. And he was really focused on, you know, this whole issue with big pharma and vaccines. But man, he allowed this to happen exactly under his leadership with these new dietary guidelines. And what I mean by that is that when they were putting together the initial group of people, there were probably 40 or 50 people, all sorts of scientists from across the country who wrote like this enormous document. And they had a very clear emphasis on promoting a more plant-based diet. But it was very clear that there should be, based on the science, this wasn't, you know, opinion, that there should be a reduction in the emphasis on pushing people into eating red meat and dairy. I don't know if I should blame RFK per se, but somebody allowed the next group of people of 9 or 10 people who all had links to either the beef industry, the dairy industry, poultry, protein related groups. And these guys all were being paid, you know, either as consultants or having equity in these companies or industries or whatever. What did they end up doing? Basically throwing out this 400-page report and saying, oh, no, we're going to promote red meat and dairy. And that's exactly what happened. And I just remember very clearly because I would have voted for him had he continued running for president. But it's very disappointing to me that he actually allowed corporate capture to occur with these dietary guidelines when that was the exact thing that he said he was going to try to get rid of if he was elected president.
But given his perspective on health and wellness, is it really surprising? I mean, you know, your politics aside, I will say one thing about him. He made his intentions very clear. Whether you agree with him or not, I don't happen to agree with some of what he's done, some of which I do agree with. Doesn't really impact me directly here in Canada, but he was pretty transparent about where he was going. I think the real problem is it undermines credibility, right? Like if the notion of government is that they're there to serve the people and there are, commercial aspects that people are benefiting from the decisions that are being made by themselves, well, then how can we trust them?
Exactly. Well, there's no such thing as the blueberry lobby, right? Or the broccoli lobby. You know, those things don't exist. But we know that the beef industry, the poultry industry, the egg industry, the dairy industry, these industries have very significant resources and they do their best to make sure that whatever the government recommends is going to be beneficial to their industries and the companies under them. And to me, to add to the point that you just made that I totally agree with about credibility, is that these new dietary guidelines completely ignore, literally at this point, thousands of scientific articles published related to how much disease risk goes up, whether it's cancer, cardiovascular, diabetes, obesity, total mortality, you name it, when you consume more red meat and dairy. I mean, to me, it's just shocking.
Okay. So let's say you're in charge of things. What diet would you recommend?
Well, I have eaten, for full disclosure to our listeners, I have eaten a whole food plant-based diet for the last 27 years. Now, I grew up in a family that ate beef every day. My dad didn't think a meal was a meal without some sort of meat, usually beef, a glass of milk, and a piece of bread. You could serve that man anything else, but he'd like those three components. So two out of the three were the things that, you know, I just didn't think any differently. If I was in RFK's position, I would have gone much more with what that original scientific body recommended, where it was much more focused on eating a whole food plant-based diet. Again, they weren't trying to convert everybody to being vegetarian or vegan, but they were definitely saying, hey, wait a minute, Americans are already eating too much meat and dairy. We've got to, you know, get people to understand that the science is suggesting all of these risks with eating these foods, and we've got to get people to start recognizing that. Whether they reduce it or not is up to them. I honestly cannot tell you that I know one person that said, hey, John, did you read the new dietary guidelines? Like, that doesn't even happen. So maybe the good side to this story is that the average American is not even reading those dietary guidelines. The bad news, though, is that the school districts end up creating menus based around a lot of these recommendations and guidelines. That's where it concerns me, because then they're just going to follow along with it. And now the next thing you know, all of our children will be eating hamburger every single day and drinking their whole milk. And that's a problem.
So the reason, you know, what's unspoken here is the reason why it might be better to eat a plant-based diet. Right. In terms of nutrition. Right. In terms of, you know, like cutting out the red meat and dairy because of, you know, the fat and polyunsaturated and monounsaturated, all those issues. But also having a varied plant-based diet can help your health overall. Right. It isn't just about getting your fat, your sugar, your carbs, you know, balanced with the other nutrients. There's more to it, isn't it?
No question about it. Well, and before I answer that directly, I will just say that what the research, if people are questioning, what's this guy Lewis talking about? Well, first of all, the fatty acids in beef and any meat actually that's cooked at a very high heat, they actually become carcinogenic and genotoxic. So they actually have the ability, because of their modified forms, once they're cooked, to actually create adducts within our DNA. And that ultimately means that our cells do not replicate themselves well over time, which eventually leads to damaged cells, which eventually can lead to cancer. I'm not saying it's 100% guarantee, but that is what the research suggests. And then on the dairy side, in addition to the fat and the protein content, you have all of these hormones, all these lactoferrins, immunoglobulins. These are things that every mammal in its infancy needs to grow and develop. But there is no biological justification for why any adult human needs to be consuming the breast fluid from cows or any other mammals, because you're continuing to signal to all those growth factors and metabolic pathways that lead to obesity and diabetes and cancer and all these other things. So that, I just wanted to make sure people understand why I'm advocating against continuing to eat these foods. As far as a more of an approach to a whole food plant-based diet, I would say that you get a much larger spectrum of all the nutrients and the phytonutrients that our cells need to function properly. We need about 40 different nutrients, compounds, elements for our cells to function. And when you eat all the different colors of the fruits, vegetables, I say eat the rainbow. When you eat all the different colors, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and grains, you get all of those in wide and diverse amounts that help your cells to function properly. And ultimately, all that circles back to not only being overall healthy, but preventing you from getting, again, cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, all of these things that are now killing us today.
Okay. Unfortunately, we only have time for one last question, and I'll sort of parse it out for you. What you're saying, I think, for most people is very abstract. Like, I agree with you, but it's really hard to make that argument because it's intangible. Let's make it tangible for everybody. What kind of bodily changes can you expect to have by changing to a plant-based diet? And how long would it take to see those changes?
Usually when we talk about making changes to your behaviors, to your lifestyle, I like to tell people, give it at least 90 days, because it takes time for the cells to turn over. It takes time for different metabolic processes to occur. With nutrition, you need time for things to turn over and to replace themselves. Shifting to a more whole food plant-based diet, many times people will report that they have better energy, they feel healthier, they feel more alert. Certainly their gut is going to function better. Your gut is going to start functioning much better when you get more fiber into the diet. So there could be a whole host of things that people would experience. Give it at least 90 days as you start making changes, because, again, you need to allow the time for the body to do what it does best, and that is its inherent intelligence to repair and heal itself.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that.
Thank you. It's been a great time.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Rachel Meehan, Dr. Natalia Borakowski, Dr. Julie Merriman, and Dr. John Lewis. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin, wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.